Coming up on Fronteras, USDA has rescinded a ban on inspectors working at what used to be the largest single point of entry for Mexican cattle into the U.S.
Now we can go back and do business the old way like we used to do. More ranchers will come through here and help the communities.
The agency's hoping to invigorate a cattle trade that's been hurt in both countries. And thousands of unaccompanied minors from Central America are making their cases in U.S. courts. Fronteras commentator Yvette Benavides spent a day inside an immigration courtroom in San Antonio.
Jose speaks in a whisper of a voice. His stature and slight build belie his 17 years. He could pass for 12 in his humble attire, a faded beige shirt and checkered pants from another era.
Benavides takes us to immigration court during Fronteras. First, the news. This is Fronteras, the journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among several public radio stations along the Southwest. I'm Crystal Chavez in San Antonio. The USDA has rescinded a 2012 ban on inspectors working at what was once the largest single point of entry for Mexican cattle into the United States until 2 years ago. Lauren Madelon reports from Mexico that the lifting of the ban signals a small but significant shift in border policy. The USDA is signaling that some places on the border are safe enough to continue its work. And in returning to Mexico, the agency's hoping to invigorate a cattle trade that's been hurt in both countries.
That's a sound that's been sorely missed here in Chihuahua. Cattle from the Mexican interior are readied for inspection before crossing into the U.S. For 90 years, Mexican cattle grown chiefly for the American fast food industry has made its last stop on the trip north here, Ganadera, Chihuahua, in Ojinaga, near the Texas border.
Siempre ha sido la más importante.
This was always the most important cattle crossing, says Mexican veteran Arian Jesus Vaca. That ended 2 years ago, and Vaca thought his career might be over. Citing unspecified security concerns in Ojinaga, the USDA forbade its inspectors from crossing the border here. Before the ban, says Vaca, 250,000 head of cattle were checked here each year by the USDA. That meant less time and paperwork to cross. Since then, ranchers have headed west to an inspection station on the New Mexico border. That added many hours to the trip and stress for the animals. And when animals are stressed, they lose weight and value.
No podemos recuperar en una semana lo que perdimos en dos años.
We can't get back in 1 week what we lost over 2 years, says Vaca, but he's hopeful.
You don't know what you have until you lose it.
So is Presidio, Texas Mayor John Ferguson. Ranchers used to generate $5 million a year in local tax-generating revenue, hotels, meals, gasoline.
When you hear about all the chaos and insecurity on the border, it's just absolutely not the case here. You know, compared to other border crossings, it's just been almost an asterisk.
There were 6 murders last year in Ojinaga, a town of 30,000 people. 4 of those killings were clearly related to organized crime. That's still a murder rate of a small fraction of 1%. An internal USDA memo says, quote, necessary changes have been made to safeguard inspectors.
Por fin tomaron en cuenta la situación real.
They finally saw the real situation, says Manuel Varela. He heads the Chihuahua Alfalfa Producers Union. More cattle passing through means more alfalfa is sold.
Todo el ámbito que está rodeando esta actividad lícita y segura.
Everything in our work is legal and safe, Varela says. That's the Mexican side of the story. But there are benefits for U.S. cattle interests, too. Salvador Baeza is a cattle broker.
¿Cuándo pasa? ¿Mañana? Ándale, pues.
He receives certified Mexican cattle in Texas. He then moves that cattle on to customers like McDonald's and Burger King.
Now we can go back and do business the old way like we used to do. More ranchers will come through here and help the communities. Presidio in Ojinaga.
This is unquestionably an economic good news story for people on both sides of at least 2 border towns, but they say they're not expecting the missing dollars to reappear anytime soon.
The harvest of cattle begins in earnest in October, and it's not until then that they expect the economic benefit to the reopening of this inspection facility to be realized. I'm Lorne Madelon in Ojinaga, Chihuahua.
For most of its life, the small border city of Presidio, Texas, has been on the edge of the electric grid. This rugged part of West Texas has seen a major upgrade of its transmission lines over the past 5 years. But before that, it was pretty much the Wild West of the grid. For decades, the only power lines coming in and out of the region hung from old wooden poles built in the 1950s. As part of Marfa Public Radio's series looking at the future of solar power in Texas, Travis Bubenik reports on how, after the upgrades, Presidio turned to the sun to make blackouts and power surges a thing of the past.
The noise is those inverters actually working, because we got DC power collecting from the sun, and then it goes to the inverter, so we invert it to AC power to be able to send it to the grid.
Edgar Briones is the only guy that works here at the Acacia Solar Plant. It's just him and about 42,000 solar panels and that constant high-pitch humming in the background.
Here we go again.
That's the sound of the panels turning to follow the sun's path. They adjust automatically every few minutes. The power this plant churns out is actually sold to the city of Bryan, across the state in the Hill Country, but Presidio still reaps the benefit.
We are putting out more power from this plant alone than the entire city uses, daily.
The city's economic development director, Brad Newton, says the power used to drop out even with small thunderstorms miles away. But ever since the plant came online a year ago, the lights here stay on, even when they're out across the region.
We've been out of power since Saturday.
When we covered the ice storm that hit last fall, people in Marfa, Fort Davis, and other towns were shivering in the cold without power for days, but the heaters in Presidio stayed on. The plant sits down a dirt road outside of town, so it's hard to know it's even here. Briones says a lot of people still don't.
Every time I cross the border, like the U.S. Customs would tell me, hey, where you work at? Solar plant. Where's that at? So they don't even know it's here, and they actually work and live here in Presidio also.
But Presidio's actually been in the solar game for a few years now. Its wastewater flows through a solar-powered treatment plant, and the local schools have panels of their own. Brewster McCracken is the CEO of the Pecan Street Research Institute in Austin, studying small-scale renewable energy technology.
If you would have asked me a year ago, well, what's happening with solar, I would have said, it's on, at best-case scenario, a real slow glide-up. But that is clearly not happening anymore.
The looming solar boom in West Texas is proof of that. Companies from California to France say the market's just now getting strong enough where they can turn a profit in Texas. Three utility-scale plants are in the works right now, and one's already being built near Fort Stockton. But it's not like this is all some utopian green dream.
Personally, the natural gas, to me, I think would be a good thing for the city.
Presidio Mayor John Ferguson says he's against drilling anywhere in the Big Bend. But he does see the need for a diverse energy mix, so he's all for using gas that's pumped in from somewhere else. Right now, the city doesn't have access to natural gas, but he says if it did, that could bring in manufacturing.
I know that there's a major plant that would like to open up, but they need the natural gas first, and so there's some chance for employment in the future.
Brad Newton also says drilling doesn't need to happen here, but he says the city's watching the industry in Mexico for opportunity. Government-owned Pemex is exploring for oil and gas just an hour south of the border, and Newton says Presidio could be an industry-friendly neighbor.
We would be a real good host for companies to come down and supply all the needs that they need to look for oil and gas in Mexico.
Mexico also recently announced plans for a natural gas pipeline that would stretch from Chihuahua through the border and up into the booming Permian Basin.
The more things we can bring to Presidio, the more our friends will come over and trade with us, and we'll smile all the way to the bank.
In Texas, solar is still the underdog when it comes to competing with oil and gas. State regulators still haven't called for a particular focus on developing solar power, but the state does have some of the nation's highest potential for harvesting the sun's rays. That means small-scale experiments like the ones in Presidio might become models for communities across Texas and for companies from far and wide. In West Texas, I'm Travis Bubenik.
Unaccompanied minors from Central America are making their cases in court. Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavides spent a day inside an immigration courtroom in San Antonio.
Jose speaks in a whisper of a voice. His stature and slight build belie his 17 years. He could pass for 12 in his humble attire, a faded beige shirt and checkered pants from another era.
Benavidez takes us to immigration court after the break. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. State health officials have alerted the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention about conditions in border facilities where thousands of Central American children are being detained. KERA's Shelley Koffler reports on concerns about an increased risk for the spread of disease.
4 weeks ago, the Texas Department of State Health Services sent two of its staff to federal detention facilities in Brownsville and McAllen. A one-page summary of findings provided to KERA details severe overcrowding, 5.5 square feet of living space per child when national standards call for 20. Children with contagious infections like scabies and lice were not adequately separated from the general population. Some children were held for days in an area without air conditioning, where they slept on the concrete, were exposed to insects, and temperatures reached 100 degrees. Carrie Williams is a spokesperson for State Health Services.
There are toilets in the cells where the kids eat and sleep, and so that just really opens the door up for spread of disease. You know, whenever you have people staying in close quarters, there is just an increased risk of disease spread and outbreak.
Williams says Texas Health Commissioner David Lakey visited the same facilities again last week. The non-air-conditioned area was not being used, but little else had changed. Williams says Lakey contacted the director of the Centers for Disease Control.
We do think the CDC should have more involvement given their expertise in disease management.
In an email, the CDC said it's consulting with a separate federal agency that provides medical screenings after the children are moved from the detention centers to longer-term housing. We requested an interview with U.S. Customs and Border Protection, which oversees the detention centers, but have received no response. Jessica Maxwell, with a division under Homeland Security, says before children enter detention, they're visually checked for signs of illness like rashes or coughing.
If they are found to be suffering from a serious medical affliction, then they're transported to the local emergency department for treatment. If someone is found to have a communicable disease, then they are quarantined from the general detainee population.
Williams says State Health Services would like to see more thorough health screenings before children enter detention. She acknowledges, however, that the level of illness reported to her agency so far has been consistent with what's in Texas's general population. 3 children with flu, 3 with tuberculosis, dozens with chickenpox. Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins has repeatedly said North Texans should not be concerned that 2,000 of these children may soon be transferred to shelters here.
The diseases that these children may carry are diseases, for the most part, that go through every elementary school and DISD every year.
But Williams says State Health Services is concerned that conditions are ripe for disease among a population that may have reduced resistance after an exhausting, trauma-filled journey. Shelley Koffler, KERA News.
As we just heard, the federal system housing these Central American children is overwhelmed. Also overwhelmed are immigration courts. That's the next step in these children's long journey, and it can also be treacherous. A law change is being proposed in Congress that would remove some legal protections for these children and fast-track their deportations. But Texas Public Radio commentator Yvette Benavidez recently visited immigration court in San Antonio and wondered how justice is best served.
The immigration court in San Antonio is on the downtown street Dolorosa. The word means painful, a fitting name for the apprehension I felt about observing the proceedings there, where the cases of undocumented immigrant children are heard. When I enter, it's difficult not to be moved to deference in the empty quiet, with the large American flag to the left, the Justice Department seal prominently displayed on the judge's bench. It features the Latin qui pro domino justitia sequitur and three gold stars around an eagle perched on an olive branch and 13 silver arrows. The precise translation of the Latin isn't clear to most. The Justice Department offers who prosecutes on behalf of Lady Justice, but others believe it could mean who seeks for Lady Justice, which makes the subject ambiguous and speaks to the indisputable fact that the issue of the child immigrants is confounding, with no easy answers and little traction so far to resolve the attendant partisanship, the willful lack of compassion from some corners, and the universal impotence from this country and Central America to calm the flow of immigrants and stem the lawless violence that plagues their home countries and drives them to other nightmares and hazards a world away. The judge is flanked by the bailiff on one side and an interpreter on the other. On this morning, Marta Tijerina translates the necessarily scripted legalese of an efficient and attentive Judge Anibal D. Martinez into a lilting, lyrical, affectionate Spanish. She doesn't compromise the judge's intent in any of her conversions, but conveys the seriousness of the judge's admonitions with a maternal smile and encouraging nod, then looks expectantly at the nervous mothers or the little siblings fidgeting in the back row. The judge asks each attorney if Spanish is the respondent's best language, and each time the answer is yes. How can it not be the best, right here and right now? Something familiar, comforting. But there's another code to decipher here and in the 59 other immigration courts like this one throughout the United States. The cryptic numbers that name cases or requisite forms, the admission and concession of this and that allegation, the contemplated relief for each young client, the adjudications and waivers, the E-28s for the SIJs and the UACs. The judge rarely alters the script for the many children before him. Nearly every one of them learns the same fate of a forestalled SIJ or special immigrant juvenile status. It's a strange, sad club they're in. Each one experienced untold horrors back home, traversed the merciless terrain, the ominous river, and an inauspicious entry in this country. One boy, Jose, came to the States over a year ago from San Salvador. His father and mother left the country and left him with his grandmother when he was four. His father ended up in Austin. His mother moved to the Midwest. At 17, Jose's assimilation has not been easy. Living with his father, after over 13 years apart, became difficult, and he was thrown out of the house. But today, he's in the courtroom with his father, his stepmother, and little brothers who are American citizens, born in the USA. In spite of the difficulty of managing in the States, Jose insists that nothing can make him return to San Salvador, where he did his best in his grandmother's care and in school, but was still incessantly harassed by the anarchic gangs who tried to recruit him and threatened to kill him and his family if he did not comply. Jose speaks in a whisper of a voice. His stature and slight build belie his 17 years. He could pass for 12 in his humble attire, a faded beige shirt and checkered pants from another era. Even so, he walks with a swagger. He's cool and world-weary. But I see, too, a sweet wholesomeness in his and in every face of each child in the courtroom. They could be my own children, San Antonio's own children, Carlos and Oscar, Aide, Elias, Arsenio, Maria, Milagros, Yeral, Enrique, and a very short, skinny boy with the unlikely name of Elvis. With the final hearing of the docket, one for a juvenile who did not make the scheduled court date and is now considered removable or deportable, we rose to our feet as Judge Martinez took his leave. While I'd been uneasy about entering the courtroom, I wasn't quite as eager to leave. This seemed a safe place, a fair place, as fair as it can be, for now. Walking back into the day, I made my way to my car. People walked down the street or stood on corners waiting for the bus. Everyone was moving, getting to the next place on Dolorosa.
Frontera's commentator Yvette Benavides teaches English composition and literature at Our Lady of the Lake University. San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro's preparing to depart for our nation's capital. Area Chambers of Commerce recently hosted a community celebration in his honor. Texas Public Radio's Ryan Lloyd reports.
In pure San Antonio style, people came to honor the man who's led the city for the past 5 years. The community, business leaders, and city staff members came to hear Julian Castro say goodbye. He said the most special day he's had as mayor was welcoming the kids to Pre-K 4SA last summer.
The parents seemed nervous, and some of them were crying, but the kids seemed very excited. Well, some of them were crying too, but they mostly seemed excited. If I've tried to do anything as mayor, it has been to look beyond the things that we can throw a stone at or that we can say we've accomplished within a couple of years, and to think about those things that are longer lasting, like the education of a young person.
As Castro leaves, many people are focused on the initiatives like Pre-K 4SA that'll leave behind. During his goodbye, he almost seemed to give marching orders to city and community leaders. He said the most important thing to do is to continue the vision set out by the public in the SA 2020 plan. That encompasses numerous areas like education, health, and civic engagement. He said the first thing he hung up in his office as mayor was a poster from his mother's 1971 city council campaign that Rosie Castro didn't win. But he said she put the wind in the sails of many others.
Not only did young folks like me win, but San Antonio won, and America has won. Thank you.
Ryan Lloyd, Texas Public Radio News.
Castro begins his job with the Department of Housing and Urban Development on July 28th. That's Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the growing Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations all along the Southwest. This music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. You can find past shows and listen to this show again, share it with friends and family with one-click buttons to social media from tpr.org. Just search for Fronteras under the Programs tab. I'm Crystal Chavez in San Antonio.